In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. One of the most awkward realities of modern life is that of the reply all. Glad there's a little uncomfortable laughter, because if you have been the victim of a reply all, or the recipient of a reply all, or you've been the one clicking reply all, you know how entangled you can become with ill feeling very quickly. I'm talking, of course, about when someone sends out an email to a lot of people and you respond, or someone responds, with something that is meant only for the ears of the person who sent the email. But they click reply all and everyone hears. Now, sometimes you're the person writing the reply all mistakenly. But oftentimes you're the one reading the reply all, and it's annoying, or you're the one about whom is being spoken. You get some kind of unedited thought about your personality or something you've done that really bites. It stings. And if this has happened to you, it's probably ruined your day, maybe your week, maybe your year. I don't know. I hope it hasn't happened, but it does happen. Tim Kreider, who writes for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and a variety of other outlets, he was the recipient of just such an email. And someone had let fly something about his person in a reply all that was not meant for his ears. And it took him aback. But he thought, you know, this phenomenon is a helpful window into the reality of our lives, of where we actually live, of sort of what is going on in the unedited machinations of human relationships. And he came to the following conclusion. He said, "I've often thought that the single most devastating cyber attack a diabolical mind could design would not be on the military or financial sector, but simply to simultaneously make every email and text ever sent universally public. The fabric of society would instantly evaporate. Civilization would collapse in an apocalypse of bitter recriminations and weeping, breakups and fistfights, divorces and bankruptcies, scandals and resignations, blood feuds, litigation, wholesale slaughter in the streets." Now, you don't have to be a technological person to identify. I could have, if I had footage of your last 24 hours, and I had a subtitle of your thoughts, and I aired it in Lee Park, you would have a heart attack. Because no one here is without sin. And that is what we are talking about today. This is why the great American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, people sometimes misattribute this quote to G.K. Chesterton, and maybe he intimated it, but Niebuhr is the one who put it in writing. He called original sin the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian faith, by which he meant simply that our histories, both global and personal, bear out the Bible's claim that our basic nature as men and women is fatally compromised. Fatally compromised. Because everywhere in our society, in our culture, we hear about human potential and about goodness and about progress. And maybe there's a time and place for that kind of talk. But in Lent, and this is the first Sunday of Lent, we are reminded explicitly of the reality of human weakness, of frailty, mortality, and culpability. And so it's no coincidence that the reading tonight is from Genesis, this episode that so many of us have grown up with and that we've heard countless times, the story of Eve and the serpent and the apple and the tree. But what happens in it? Well, we hear that at first, when man and women were created, they were created in a state of total dependence on God. Glorious dependence on God. Every need was taken care of. All this incredible food and beauty and love and sustenance, it was coming to them independent of their having done anything for it, or even knowing where or why it was coming to them. They're not even wearing any clothes here. That's how taken care of they are. But then, as we know, the lie comes in. It starts with that classic, did God really say, dot, dot, dot? And a seed is planted. And Eve, who is a stand-in for you and I, soon starts to feel that something is being withheld from her. And if you have ever felt something is being withheld from you, something that you feel you deserve, heaven help you. Because that is a justification for doing just about anything. But Eve is no longer satisfied with dependence and sort of the blessed state of passive reception that we see in the garden. She wants to get behind the curtain. She wants to know what's going on. She wants to be like God. And that is the original sin here. It's not so much a fall as a reaching upward and beyond to being like God. You shall not die. It's the sin of pride, of not wanting anyone to tell you what to do, to being the arbiter of your own fate, deciding for yourself what is right and what is wrong. And it's so ingrained in our DNA that to even voice these things feels like you're assaulting the basic premise of human life, that I have the right to decide what is right and what is wrong. Yet the clearest picture I know of original sin is that from the book Grace and Addiction, which describes life as a play. Can you imagine the chaos that would break out on set if one of the actors tried suddenly to usurp the director's role? The chaos probably wouldn't last very long because the actor would soon be on his way out the door in search of a new job. Imagine further the insanity that would ensue if all the actors in the show somehow got the same wrong idea about their roles and they all started trying to control the production simultaneously, each with a different idea of how the story should be written. Now, if that isn't an accurate picture of what life in this world is actually like, I don't know what is. It's not a happy picture. It's not an optimistic picture. But it is one that accounts for much of the pain and worry that mark our lives. And yet, as empirically verifiable as this doctrine of original sin is, it remains such a dirty word. No one likes it. Those on the left tend to think that talking about ourselves as sinners is the same thing as having low self-esteem. That sin is an antiquated notion that only makes us feel bad about ourselves, so should we avoid mentioning it at all? And then there are those on the right, I'm caricaturing both here, that equate sin almost exclusively with immoral action. That it's avoidable if you can just keep it under wraps and squeak out that clean life. But when sin is boiled down to low self-esteem or immoral action, it becomes something we can control or limit rather than something to which we are in bondage, a condition, not something we choose, something we inherit, something that is internal as well as external. And for me, original sin has come to be simply a synonym for the human condition. I mean, think about it. How many of us would be willing to have all of our correspondence made universally public? Even those that we claim to love, those that are closest to us, those would probably be the most hurt, right? I mean, what if I even made your last 24 hours worth of correspondence public? This is not just a story about a garden. 100% of us are afraid of exposure. Just like Eve, you realize that you are naked and you cover yourself up. And in fact, how do we cope with our sin and the resulting fear of exposure and shame? Well, the modern word is management. We manage our accounts the click of a button. We manage our careers. We manage our relationships and our personalities. We do everything we can to prevent an unmanaged version of ourself or our life to be made public, or for anything that involves us to escape our sphere of influence, our management of it. which is simply another way of saying that we put clothes on. We manage what people see of us. There's an incredible instance of this a few weeks ago in February around Valentine's Day. There's a column in the New York Times every Sunday called Modern Love. Maybe you know it. And it is sort of, it's this every single week there's a story of someone's romantic life. And it kind of doubles as like a pulse of what is going on in the state of human relationships and romance in America, at least. And the writer, Daniel Jones, the editor, he sort of used the opportunity to kind of check in on what's going on in American romance. And he said he saw the most interesting thing. He said that 3 years ago, they have a contest for college essays every 3 years. And 3 years ago, what he saw was young people struggling with the hookup culture. And you know what I'm talking about when I talk about hookup culture. I'm talking about the desire and fervent, vigorous attempt to separate physical and emotional intimacy. And what he says is that it wasn't working out as well as people had hoped, that it was not proving to be as easy a separation, and that there's a lot of stories about coming to terms with that. But then he said 3 years later, what he saw was the complete inverse. You saw the phenomenon of what's known as a soulmate in a box, an online relationship that is purely emotional in nature, in which you share absolutely everything about your life with another person, yet it has no physical component. And in fact, the stories that he found was that when people tried to bring it into the physical realm, all the editing that was going on in the name of complete and utter vulnerability, these relationships just fizzled out. Because you were editing out the things that, you know, not the emotional wounds, you were editing out the stuff that actually gets on people's nerves about one another. Meaning the way they smell, the way they chew their food, their sort of mannerisms in social settings. The stuff you really can't stand about another person, I've heard in marriage. that come out that you cannot, that no one's putting on their online profile. And they tend to be slightly mundane things. But Daniel Jones writes this, he says, "We're always searching for new ways of finding love that don't involve having to feel insecure or vulnerable. Because who wants to feel insecure or vulnerable for the purpose of this story? Who wants to ever be actually naked? Who wants to be judged and rejected? So when we get the chance to hide, whether through typed messages we can edit and control, or through Skype conversations that we can cut off at any time, we're freed from much of that anxiety, and we're fooled into thinking this may be a better and truer way of having a relationship. These soulmate-in-a-box relationships, which are all about sharing your every thought, idea, and emotional burp, but they are also crucially about being able to close your laptop and turn off your phone whenever you want to and continue with your life as you wish, unencumbered." Interesting. I mean, all of us want love without any kind of vulnerability or cost. Or we want the naked part without the naked part. If you pardon, I can't do the southern thing. But, you know, I'm talking about sex without emotion. We want to avoid any possibility of shame, ever. And yet there are factors that it turns out cannot be circumvented in the pursuit of affection. Much as we wish that it weren't the case, love without vulnerability, without cost, without sacrifice, isn't really love. I wish that weren't true. But no one ultimately feels loved when their profile, or some online version of them, or some incredibly the complicated clothes that we wear in our relationships, some online projection, or some in-person projection of an identity. No one feels loved when that is what's getting the hoped-for response, because we know that that's only a small sliver of who we actually are. And so we feel more isolated than we did before. In this way, the clothing designed to afford us intimacy, to bring us love, only makes us more lonely. So what does this have to do with the garden? Or what one bishop calls the good news of original sin? You know, T.S. Eliot, in his Choruses from the Rock, wrote, "Why should men love the church? Because she tells them of sin and death, and other unpleasant facts of life that they would as soon forget. Why would I come up here and tell you that there's something good, that you should love the church for talking to you about sin? Or original, that there's any good news in original sin? The idea that you are not as in control of your life as you think you are, your potential is far more limited than you've been led to believe, that your aspirations are going to be forgotten, and you're going to die. That's what Lent is about. Let's be real. How is that not extremely depressing? Well, the good news here is that we spend so much of our lives pretending, covering up our unloving and self-interested behavior, that to be given the permission from on high, to let down our guard, at least before God, I think that's an enormous relief. Nadia Boltz-Weber, the great preacher, says this. She says, there is great hope in Lent, a great hope in admitting our mortality and brokenness, because then and only then do we finally lay aside our sin management program long enough to allow God to be God. She says that original sin actually isn't depressing. That we are in bondage to the human condition and cannot free ourselves, that's not depressing. What's depressing is the desperation of trying to pretend otherwise. What's depressing is to insist that I can free myself, I just haven't managed to pull it off yet. That's what creates low self-esteem. The idea not only that you should be something else, but you could be something else, and you are not that something else. That's not original sin. That is a very inflated view of the human condition. Karl Barth once wrote, said, only Christians sin. And what he meant was that the person who doesn't know a gracious God can never be truly honest about their shortcomings. C.S. Lewis said the same thing, basically, when he was asked why so many people who are atheists are really such good people. And they are. They really are. Lewis responded, well, they have to be good, don't they? If you don't believe in a God who forgives, you are damned to unrelenting goodness. Oof. Jeez. Smoke your pipe, Dr. Lewis. If you don't believe in a God who forgives, you are damned to unrelenting goodness. That's quite a thing to say. But in light of original sin, what I'm trying to tell you is that the great question of life is not if our addiction to management will cause us to act in foolish and self-seeking and wrong-headed ways, but what will happen when we do. It means that the great theme of human life, human existence, is the presence or lack of love that we experience in those times of self-defeat. Fortunately, this is also the great theme of the Bible, which says that the solution to sin and the loneliness and rebellion and acrimony that it causes is not a theology, but a person. It's not a what, but a who. Theodore Parker Ferris, the rector of Trinity Church in Boston in the early part of the last century, was having dinner once with a young man, and they were talking about the young man's father, who was known to be a stern and exacting man. The son said that when he had been in the army, he had made a terrible mistake. He'd gotten into trouble and was given a dishonorable discharge. He knew that what he had done had disgraced his family, and he was sure that his father would be outraged. But he also felt that he had to tell his dad what happened. So I did, the son said. I wired him and told him what happened. He sent a telegram back, and the telegram had three sentences in it. I will stand by you no matter what happens. I will be there in the morning. Remember whose you are. In this young man's life, the person who was assumed to be an enemy turned out to be a friend. Now, when was the last time you were at a rehearsal dinner for a wedding? Rehearsal dinners are notoriously awkward affairs. Sometimes someone hits the reply all button, basically. They've had a little too much to drink. And you watch the bride and groom's face as they watch sort of their friends share stories about them. Oh, you should have known them back then, you know. I can't believe you actually got your act together. You got someone to say yes. Or they share embarrassing stories. But sometimes someone really does have too much to drink, and they say something you really shouldn't. They say something, well, you should have seen how her first marriage blew up. Or they say, he didn't just have a problem with alcohol, he got arrested. Wait, what? You didn't tell me that. It's not just innocuous, endearing stories that come out. It's these dark stories that hint at the fact that someone in the room has a past. And the fear you see in people's eyes is the fear of exposure before others and before God, and it's based on the fact that all of us have a real past with real stories that could easily come out if the wrong person got the microphone. And that fear is not just some kind of general psychologized guilt, but it's rooted in deliberate thoughts and actions that rightfully should condemn us. This is real guilt, and it builds real debilitating fear, and it inspires people to hide. And yet into this cycle of self-recrimination and self-defeat and rightful condemnation breaks the message of the gospel. The message that on the cross, God has levied our embarrassing stories, but also our most shameful realities. He has levied on the innocent in our place so that we might stand known and naked before God without fear or hiding. We, you, me, can rest secure knowing that we are absolved and that the microphone has never been in better hands. In fact, the toast is only three lines long. I will stand by you no matter what happens. I will be there in the morning. Remember whose you are.